Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Be Unique Unscripted, because an authentic life is unscripted. Presented by Bronner House Museum, Eliza Kaler, the spiritual therapist, and Little Green Oasis. Unscripted brings you amazing guests and open mic nights every Thursday night at 9 o'clock Eastern Time. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an opportunity to learn more. Visit our calendar on beunique.org to see who we have scheduled to appear next. That's BUNEKE.org.
Well, hello, everybody. It is Thursday night, my favorite night of the week, because I get to talk to some of the most amazing people. If you don't remember, I am Mary Brotherton, your host of The Unique Unscripted. Tonight, my guest is Emmy Award winner and New York Times bestseller Lionel Friedberg. And I'm going to admit, before I found his book, I had never heard of Lionel. However, I've heard of a lot of his work. And I'm sure you have too. He wrote a best-selling book called Forever in My Veins, How Film Led Me to the Mysterious World of the African Shaman. And I love, love, love that. Welcome to the show, Lionel.
Thank you, Mary.
Glad to have you here.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be with you and with all of your listeners. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, you are very welcome. Now, I could go on and give a bigger introduction about who you are, but there's so many things that I really want to talk about that I don't want to spend a lot of time when people can go back to the show and read the description of who you are. But I will say, if anyone's listening live right now on Thursday night, September 9th, you can call in and talk with us. The number is 516-418-5651. We have the show live every Thursday night. It goes archived and you can listen to it whenever you want to in the future. I will say this though, Lionel has spent 50 years making films, and he grew up in South Africa, but he began his career during the dying days of colonialism, and his book, Forever in My Veins, is I think it's a very powerful book because it speaks to me about the soothsayers, diviners, herbalists, traditional medicine practitioners. And I know that your book has a lot of references to the, I'm not sure if I can pronounce this correctly, Nganga?
Yeah, that's the term in Zambia. Nganga, actually, is the but the term that is most often used, particularly in southern Africa today, is Sangoma. That's the more common phrase that people use.
Okay, I saw that too in the book, yes.
Yeah.
Now, you apparently are open to having people tell you things that they know that you don't know yet, things that have come to pass in your lifetime. That later on you realize, oh, that's what she meant.
Like, that's exactly the idea.
The time that you were charged by a great beast in the bush.
Yeah.
You want to tell me about that?
You know, I can tell you all sorts of stories like that. Let's help your listeners along a little bit, just to put things in perspective. And that is, as you said earlier, I grew up in South Africa, and those were the days when apartheid ruled supreme. The country was divided right down the middle. So black and white members of society never met. It was completely a segregated society, and it was pretty brutal in the way these laws and regulations were implemented. This was not a choice of people. This was the law of the land. that black and white did not meet. And so this is the world I lived in as a child, and I was an only child. And so, of course, being of the privileged white class, you know, we all had nannies and servants and whatever else. When I was a little tyke, I was probably maybe 5 or 6 years old, being an only child. Both my parents worked. And one day my nanny, who was also the maid at the house, she said, on a Thursday, funnily enough, as like it is today, Thursdays were half days off for black servants who worked in white households. And she said to me, "You want to come with me this afternoon? I'm going to go and visit a friend." And I said, "Yeah, absolutely, of course, yeah." So we went down the road, and we met a friend of hers who lived in the sort of sparse, very, very primitive, basic kind of conditions that she lived in a little room in the backyard, way down at the back end of the backyard of this house, which is like our maid lived in the same kind of conditions. And we went down there to see her friend, and when we got down there, the door was closed, and there were some people waiting outside the room, and I said, "Is this where your friend lives?" And she said, "Yeah, just wait. She's seeing some people at the moment." And I said, you know, as a kid always says, "Why?" And she said, "Well, because she's also a doctor." And I thought, what is she talking about? You know, what do you mean? Anyway, so the door opened eventually, and a couple of people came out, black folks, and then these two people went in, and they were there for about maybe 15 minutes, and then the door opened, she welcomed us in. And when I went inside this room, it was like going into another world, because the smells and the sights, it was very sort of gloomy, dark interior there. There was the curtain, there was a little drape over the window, which was closed, and I could see on the shelves all around her room, strange object, you know, feathers and bones and powders and pebbles and herbs and all sorts of weird containers and whatever else. And I said to her, "What do you do here?" And she said, "Well, I'm a doctor." And I said, "How?" And she said to me, "Sit down." And I sat down on the floor, and on the floor was a grass mat. And on this grass mat was a little bag, a little antelope skin bag. And she said, "You pick that up," which I did. And she said, "Now shake it," which I did. And she said, "Turn it upside down." And I did that. And what fell out were a bunch of bones and stones and little objects, tiny little things. I'm not, when I say bones, I'm talking about small bones, like little knuckle bones and little chicken bones and things of that mm-hmm. kind. And they fell onto this mat, and she said, "These are the things I use to help me tell people what is wrong with them. And I can also talk to people who have passed on." And I thought, oh my God, this is like out of a storybook, you know. This is like a magic lantern world that I'm in. And I didn't quite understand what she was getting at and what she explained. But later on, as I grew up and when I became an adult, all of this came into very, very sharp perspective as to what this woman had been talking about to me as a kid. But that was my introduction to it. And many, many years later, when I had moved to Central Africa to start working in television, in the first TV station, as you mentioned, in Central Africa, I was there, and it was colonial days, and I was working in what was then a British territory called Northern Rhodesia, and Britain was giving up its colonies, as were the Dutch and the Italians and the Belgians and the Germans, and everybody were giving up their African colonies and allowing these countries to become independent, self-governing states. And eventually Northern Rhodesia became independent, and the country's name was changed to Zambia, which is the country that is known today. And when that happened, the station that I was working for became nationalized by the government, because it was the only television station in the country. And so the government decided to nationalize it, which was fine. I and everybody else who worked at the station totally understood the reasoning behind it, because, you know, this was a powerful tool for the new government to use, rather than, you know, a commercial enterprise.
Right.
They got some benefit out of it. And so I understood that. However, there was a downside to it, because what they wanted to do was to replace every white person in the station with a local Zambian, a black person, which is totally understandable. But I had a dilemma, because I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. There I was, sitting in the middle of Central Africa. My dream was always to work in Hollywood and work on movies. And now suddenly I've lost this job in television. What was I going to do? So I went home late that night with this pink slip in my, you know, in my top pocket, as we all did. And the next morning, after I woke up, I usually got up around about 10 o'clock in the morning, and we had a terrific guy who worked for us at home. He was our servant. You know, again, servants, we all had servants. And he was not much older than I was. And you know, I greeted him in the morning, and I said, David, a terrible thing has happened. And he said, what? And he was a member of the Bemba ethnic group, which is the largest ethnic group in this part of the country. I said, I've lost my job, and my position, my place is going to be taken over by a Zambian, which is fine, but I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't really want to go back to South Africa because, you know, apartheid is there, and I didn't fancy going back to that country at that time. This is, well, I'm talking about 1964 now.
Uh-huh.
And she said, don't worry about a thing. I will find someone who can help you. I had no idea what he was talking about. What was he referring to, you know? Anyway, a couple of days later, he said, okay, tomorrow we take your car, we go into the bush, and we'll go meet someone who can help you. I thought, what? Like who? And he said, just trust me. Well, I did. The guy was totally trustworthy. And I had no idea what I was in for. So there we were, the two of us, bouncing in my little beat-up VW Beetle on these dirt tracks, going to this little settlement in the middle of the boondocks on the outside of a town called Ndola, which is a big one of the biggest centers in this area where I was living. And we eventually found this little house, a little hut, really. And he said, this is the place. Now, how he found it and how he got to it, I have no idea, but that's part of the mystique and the magic of living in Africa. Things never quite make sense, but there we were outside of this little hut, and he said, this is the place, and he knocked on the door, and this little old woman came to the door, and she opened it. She was half blind. She was wrapped up in a sort of warm rug, a blanket, although it was summer, it was as hot as can be, and she, you know, a little crooked finger, and she welcomed us into her house. Now, the house was literally two rooms. And the minute I went inside that room, something hit me in my memory banks. The smells were exactly what I'd smelled as a child way, way back in South Africa. And I thought, oh, my goodness, this lady, this woman, is probably also a doctor of some kind. Now, I had heard people about people like this many, many times. They were disparagingly referred to as witch doctors in those days, you know, particularly by the white community, and that was sort of looking down at them. The whites frowned down upon these people as though they were inferior, and they were involved in black magic and hocus pocus and all sorts of nonsense. They had no idea what really went on in these people's worlds. But, you know, so I thought, oh my goodness, she's got to be a witch doctor. Anyway, She said to David, she didn't speak any English at all, and she's introduced, she said that I can call her Nanga, which is the Zambian word for soothsayer, for fortune teller, for healer, for doctor, if you like. In South Africa, as I said earlier, they are go more commonly by the name of Sangoma, which means the same thing, you know, someone who can heal. And they wear many hats, these people. They can talk to the deceased. They are able to talk to, communicate with the spirit world. These bones are a channel to another universe for these people. And, you know, it's absolutely extraordinary what they can do. Because this, and I'll start with this woman. And she said to me, sit down, and in Bemba, which, and I didn't, I sat down, and I did the same thing with the bones, as I had seen done many, many years ago. I threw the bones for her. And she leaned over, and she was staring at these bones as though she was seeing a movie. And what she told me was absolutely extraordinary, because everything that she told me that long ago day on that hot summer afternoon in Zambia, every single thing she told me came true. She virtually read my life to me. She read the next 50 years to me as though she was reading a book or watching a movie. I wasn't seeing anything, but she sure was, you know. And one of the things that she said, you asked me about that great beast, she said to, well, she was talking to David because she was speaking Bemba. He was translating for me. And, you know, she was babbling away. She was talking very fast. I was desperately trying to keep up with what David was translating. But one of the things that she said to him was he must be very, very careful, because one day in his work he must be very careful of the great beast in the bush. He may die from this great beast. And I thought, what is she talking about? You know, I had no idea. That was just one example. She told me a lot of other weird stuff which came true. I'll expand on that great beast story in a minute. But, you know, she said many, many other things. She said, I will cross the great big water to the other side of the world. And she said, I will do what I do now, but there are more lights to use the word lights, there are more lights in that place than the place where I work now. And I was working in television. She didn't know that. She was describing the television station to me. You know, and she said, I will meet very famous people. She said to him, she said to David that, you know, I will, my life will be threatened one day on the big water. The big water will try to kill me. I had no idea what that meant. She said to David things like, and he will one day in his work, he will meet a man who was very, very close to the most evil man who ever lived. When I heard that, I thought, my God, I'm going to wet my pants. What is he talking about? You know. So she made all these weird predictions, many, many of them. And another one she said was, one day, and she didn't understand what she was seeing. She was seeing these images. She said to me, she said, you will go to a world where there is no color. There is only white there. There is no color in this place. Everything is white. There's no color at all. It's though she didn't
understand. And how old were you when this? How old were you at that time?
I was, at that time, I was like 20, 21.
Oh, and, yeah. So everything is like totally mysterious.
Totally. I didn't understand any of it. And, you know, it was only as these events occurred later on, I didn't wait for them to happen because, you know, and not that I dismissed her, but I kind of forgot about those things. But when they did happen, I suddenly realized, oh, my word, that's what she meant. And let's talk about the great beast for a moment. In 1967, I was given a freelance assignment. I was a freelance cinematographer. I did go back to South Africa because I had no option. And in 1967, I was given a job to do to cover a safari for a guy here from Los Angeles, which is where I live now. He ran a big toy company called Wham-O Toys. Now, Wham-O was very, very famous in its day for the hula hoop craze that swept the world. And Wham-O was the company that brought the Frisbee to the world, you know. So this guy was extremely wealthy, and he went on safari to a country called Mozambique, which is right next to South Africa, on the border of South Africa, on its east coast. It was a Portuguese territory at that time. And I was given the task of doing a movie about his safari with two of his buddies. They came out from L.A. They were, one was a stockbroker, the other one was a lawyer. And they had weapons and guns, you know, to, you could fight a war with that, what they brought with them. I took the job not because I was really all that anxious to do a film about a safari, but I wanted to know, you know, why did these guys, where was the fun and joy in killing wild animals? I just needed to find out for myself. And I thought, here's a great opportunity to discover that. That's why I took the job. And so anyway, there I was. I joined these three guys plus two big white hunters. And we went to Mozambique, to an amazing part of the world, which was like the Garden of Eden. It was full of wild animals those days, and it was just magnificent. It was just absolutely wonderful. And one particular day, it was the turn of one of these guys to shoot an elephant. And he wasn't a very good shot, this particular guy. I think he was the stockbroker. And so I positioned myself behind him, and he was in front of me with his rifle, and in the far background, in the distance, was the herd of elephants, and the big white hunter said to him, you pick out that big old bull on the right-hand side of the herd. He's old, you know, you can take him out. In other words, it's a nice way of saying you can kill him.
Right.
You can take him out. and so he shot at that bull elephant, and he missed. And the minute that happened, the herd went absolutely crazy. They went storming off in every direction, and I thought, we're all going to die. You know, we're all going to die. And all I could see through the viewfinder of my camera, and remember, this is long before the days of video, I'm holding a very heavy movie camera connected with a cable to a guy holding a big battery pack, and, you know, there's a magazine on top of it holding the film, and, you know, it's a big deal. And so I was rooted to the spot. I couldn't move. And all I could see through the viewfinder was this guy, the guy who took the shot and missed, in my frame. And in the distance, one of the elephants was a female, and she had a baby with her. And the minute she heard the gunshot, she knew that her baby was threatened, and she decided to storm this guy who pulled the trigger on the gun. And in other words, she was running towards him, and I was right behind him. I was in the way. anyway, by the time she was about maybe 8 feet away from me, he was out of the shot. He went running. And all I heard was everybody shouting, Lionel, run, run, run. I couldn't move. I was frozen. I was absolutely frozen. And when this poor elephant was about maybe 6 or 8 feet away from me, I heard over my left hand, over my my left hand side of my, you know, the side, not looking through the viewfinder, I heard bam. And one of the big white hunters had shot the elephant and right between the eyes. And she collapsed in front of me. And she collapsed right in front of me, killed over on her side, and died. And I'll tell you something really interesting is that I made a strong connection with that elephant that moment because I have had a presence all my life that I know is the spirit of an elephant, and it has been seen many, many times by Sangomas when they have thrown the bones for me. They've often said, what is this? What is this in Ndlovu? And Ndlovu is a Zulu word that means elephant. They all see this elephant. They throw the bones for me. I've seen many, many of these diviners and these Sangomas many, many times. And every time they throw the bones, they say, you realize you have a Ndlovu around you. You've got an elephant around you. For decades after the event, it's been seen that the spirit of this elephant is still around me. I dream of her. I've got elephants hanging all over my office. I've got an elephant hanging from the rearview mirror of my car because I know that she's with me. But that aside, what's important is that this elephant, if she had not been shot, she couldn't stop. She was running so fast. She would have run right into me and killed me. And how did that old woman in her hut all those years back see that, that she did, you know? And that's just one of the examples that I'm talking about. Let's talk about the white world, for example, which is the other thing, one of the other things she mentioned to me. I think the year was 1991 or thereabouts, and I was doing a series of science programs for PBS here in the States. We were doing it in conjunction with the National Academy of Sciences, and one of the shows was called Secrets from a Frozen World. And it was basically about climate change and global warming. And the ozone hole had been discovered, and we had a scientist who had discovered the ozone hole with us. So we went down to Antarctica to see what the health of planet Earth was like. Was the Earth in trouble? Were things warming up? Were humans having an influence on the environment or not? You know, was it all BS or was it true? What did the science say? So that's what the show was about. And we were down there on an icebreaker and a scientific research ship. And I think it was Christmas Eve, 1990. And the captain had stopped the ship, and there was ice all around us. And he said, tonight we party. So everybody on board the ship, you know, scientists and crew and everybody alike, were partying in the ship. And I went up to the top deck to go and catch up on my notes. And I put on my heavy jacket, and I went and sat upstairs and stared out at this world around me. And I was trying to describe the world to myself and writing it in my diary so that I could, you know, had notes for when I came back to the studio here in L.A. To write the narration. And all I could say was, this is a world without color. It's like being inside a big white translucent egg. And, you know, as I wrote those words, I thought, oh, my God, that's what that woman saw. That's what she told me.
Place where no color.
Yeah. I mean, everywhere it was pack ice from horizon to horizon. The sky was white. It was the southern summer, so the sun never set. It just became a sort of time at midnight, but never got dark. And it was like being inside a white world without any color. And, you know, this old lady had foreseen that. And on and on and on, these events kept coming and coming and coming in my life. The things that this woman had predicted, you know, it was extraordinary.
Well, I'd like for you to tell our listeners about when she said that you were going to meet a man who was closest to evil or something like that.
She had told me that I was going to meet a man who was very, very close to the most evil person who ever lived. And I had no idea what she could possibly have meant by that. So let's cut to the year 1983, and I'm working on a series of documentaries. This is in South Africa now, on the history of aviation in South Africa and the history of South African Airways, which was, in its time, one of the great international airlines. And I was doing a series of television documentaries about that, as well as some movies that were being shown on board the aircraft as part of their history, you know, to celebrate their 50th anniversary. And while we were in production, our research turned up the fact that in 1934, just after the airline was founded, they had bought brand new aircraft from a German manufacturer based in Germany. Now, in the early 30s, to fly a brand new airplane all the way down Africa was a big deal. You know, there were no weather forecasting services. There was no radio everywhere. There weren't always landing areas where you could stop in case you had technical problems. It was a major expedition and a feat and an accomplishment to do that, to fly an aircraft with limited range all the way down the continent of Africa, from Germany all the way down to South Africa, which sits at the very bottom of the continent. So it was... And as we were doing the research, we had found that the pilot of one of those delivery flights was still alive. And I said, we've got to interview the guy. And so we tracked him down. Apparently, he was still alive. He was in his late 80s. I think he was like 88 or 89. And he was still alive and living in Bavaria in Germany. And so it was arranged that I could go to his house and interview him about that delivery flight. And I was really excited about that because, you know, that's high adventure. I mean, it's, you know, flying all the way down Africa in a three-engine aircraft, one engine in the nose, one on each wing, and you don't have much fuel. You know, how do you do that? So I wanted to talk to him about that. And when we tracked him down, I was the night before we went to do the interview, there was a guy from the German government with us, with our crew, who had arranged this interview. And the night before I met him, we were sitting in the hotel, not far from this man's house in Bavaria, in a place called Ammersee, which is a very picturesque spot, just not far from Munich. And right about midnight, we'd been drinking and eating and, you know, talking and yakking away together. And this man from the German Foreign Office, he leaned over the table to me and he said, you know, how much do you really know about this guy and his background? I said, well, I don't know. All I know is that, you know, he flew that delivery flight. Why? What is there to know? And he said, well, you know, he had service during the war. And I said, well, I'm quite sure he did because this flight took place in 1934. The war was 1939 to 45. No doubt he was, you know, flew for the Luftwaffe at that time. So I'm not interested in that. What I'm interested in is that delivery flight in the early 30s. And he leaned closer to me, this guy from the Foreign Office, and he said to me, but do you know what he really did and who he really was? And I said, well, what are you trying to tell me? And he said, he indicated that I should move closer to him, and he sort of whispered in my ear, he said, he was the personal pilot of Adolf Hitler.
Oh, my goodness.
And when I heard that, I kind of wasn't sure what to say, because that's quite a big deal. And I wasn't sure now how I was going to handle this interview the next day, because you don't often meet people like that. And the next day, we went to his house. He was a sweetheart of a man. He was very elderly. He had a war injury. He'd been shot by the Russians when they liberated Berlin. And he was in the bunker with Hitler that night. And Hitler told him to get out of there, and he did. And he was shot by the Russians, and then he ended up in a gulag with the Russians for about 15 years. With his war injury. And, you know, on and on. But when the interview was all over, he spoke no English. This man from the Foreign Office was my translator. And we did the interview. And at the end of the interview, this pilot, his name was Hans Baur, Baur. Folks can look him up. He's a fascinating character. And he said to me afterwards, he said to me in German, because I can speak a little bit of German, he said, do you want to know about my life? And I said, yeah, bitte, please tell me, you know. And he called his wife and he said, please bring the photograph albums. And she brought the photograph albums out. They were all beautifully leather-bound. And he opened up this first album and then the second and the third. And it was like looking inside the inner heart of the Third Reich, because all of these henchmen and all of these Nazis were all there. And in every second photograph, he was there with his big buddy Adolf Hitler. Apparently, he and Hitler were very great friends. And Hitler had given him his wedding party in Hitler's personal apartment in Munich when he got married to his first wife. That's how close they were. And it was like looking at a story of two guys who were very, very friendly with one another, and he knew each other for many, many years. But his buddy happened to be Adolf Hitler. And, you know, he described all of this and the relationship that he had with the man. I felt no animosity towards him. He didn't say anything bad, but it was so revelatory to be so close to a man who was so close to really one of the greatest henchmen who ever lived, who was responsible for the death of millions of people, that I wasn't quite sure how to deal with it. But anyway, afternoon passed. We eventually had drinks, and, you know, we looked through these photograph albums, and it was only the end of the day when we wrapped up, the crew was wrapping up the equipment, and, you know, we had two vehicles, and then we were driving off from the house, and I looked back through the rear window of the vehicle I was sitting in, and there he was standing outside his house waving at us, this little guy and his wife next to him, and like two old-timers waving goodbye to their guests. And then we turned a corner and he was gone. And at that moment it hit me. It suddenly hit me. Do you realize who he was? When you shook his hand, you were 1 degree of separation away from Adolf Hitler. Talk about 6 degrees of separation. How many times
did
it hit
me?
Yeah. And I was overwhelmed with a sense of what had happened that afternoon, only at the end of the day when I was able to process it. And, you know, how did that woman know? She said, I will meet a man who was a very, very close person to the most evil man who ever lived. Again, how did she see that, you know, in the bones, lying on the floor, in a mud hut in Africa? It was amazing.
How many years before it happened? You know, the fact that she predicted something that might happen in Africa.
20 years. She saw that 20
years
before.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Didn't she also tell you that you would experience things that few people could even imagine?
Yes, she did. Yeah.
And you did some documentaries, I believe, about near-death experiences that really brought that.
I can go on and on. I've been very, very fortunate. I've been very lucky. I've been blessed with an amazing life. And I've made movies, films, documentaries, television series about a huge, broad range of subjects. One of the more interesting ones, the ones you've just mentioned now, was a show called Beyond Death, which I did. I don't even remember the cable company. I think it was either A&E or it could have been the History Channel. I'm not sure.
I think it was A&E, according to your documentation.
Yeah, it probably was A&E. And the brief was, you know, from the network, go and do a documentary. It was 2 hours long. Go and do a show about what happens to the personality of a person once the body dies. What happens to the spirit of the person, or the mind, or the consciousness of the person when they're dead? Where does it go? Does it exist, or does it die when the brain cells stop working? What happens to it? Go and find out. Go and talk to scientists. Go and talk to mediums. Go and talk to a bunch of people. Go and talk to people who have had near-death experiences, you know, people who have been clinically dead and then been revived. Go and ask them, what did they experience? Is there something after death? Go and find out. And that was the brief of the show. So that was the show that really took me into this world of what goes on the other side of the veil, on what happens after the body is dead. And, you know, I now have absolutely no doubt whatsoever, because of the many people who experienced near-death experiences, including children, young children. I met a pediatrician in Seattle who works with young children who survived death, were resuscitated after they were clinically dead, either after surgery or after some horrible accident. And, you know, all of these kids that I talked to, they all told me the same thing, you know, talking about this tunnel of light, and that there were angels and there were white figures, and, you know, they either met their grandparents, or they met God, or they met Jesus, or, you know, so there's no question that once we pass over to the other side, that's not the end of the story at all. And then I have learned from other cultures, including many, many folks in Africa, you know, that death is just another doorway to another reality, and on and on. And that certainly has been backed up many, many times. If one studies Eastern philosophy, you know, you learn the same thing. And so I have absolutely no question in my mind, based on what I learned during the making of that show, that when your body is dead, you don't go die with it. Your consciousness prevails.
Oh, I agree. One of the things that you had brought up, not tonight, but in your dossier, about the two mothers who never knew each other. They were brought together physically after their sons met,
yes,
after death.
Right.
And
yeah,
that hit me really in the solar plexus, because my husband and I met online before the first dating app was ever invented.
Okay.
We just met in a very random way.
Okay.
And maybe 5-6 years later, I had a vision of his mother and my father, who both had deceased before we met.
And who did
they
not know one another, right?
They didn't know. They had no, there was no way they could have known each other, because
yeah,
he was from Florida, I was from South Carolina, and our parents didn't travel in the same circles.
Right.
But they were together. And they told me one day, we put you two together. We made sure the two of you would meet.
Amazing, amazing.
And when I read that about those two mothers, it just, wow, it's chill bumps.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very famous story, by the way. And it's been, that story features in at least two books that I know of that have been written about life after death. But in the movie, we do tell that story, and I have the two mothers meeting one another. And I'll just very briefly, just for the folks who are listening, these are two separate mothers, and they each had teenage sons, and each of their sons passed away. The kid was killed in a horrible accident on his motorcycle, and the other one, the son, died on the operating table. Now, these two boys did not know one another, and these two mothers did not know one another. But here's the amazing thing. The one mother starts to dream about the other mother's son, who she meets in her dreams with her own son. And the other mother dreams about her son meeting this mother's son in her dreams. And it's a long, long story how they got together. But eventually, the guy who wrote the definitive book about this case, he managed to get these two women together. And, you know, it was absolutely amazing, because I filmed the two mothers meeting for the first time after their sons had both been dead for at least a year. And they're meeting for the first time, and when they exchange stories and they, you know, and images, and, you know, looking at each other's photograph albums, and they said, yes, that's the kid I was dreaming about with my son. This boy of mine and my son are now our friends in spirit world, and they've been visiting us. Each of those mothers had similar experiences. It is an extraordinary story.
I love it. I love that kind of stuff. It's it's reaffirming. What we do here on Earth does have a purpose, and there's a reason.
Sure.
And it goes with us. When we leave this earthly plane, all of that stays with us, I believe.
No question about it. And then probably continues onwards in some series where after that, you know. I don't doubt that either. I'm a profound believer, because based on my experiences and people I talk to and shamans that I've spoken to, you know, that reincarnation is a reality. This is not all there is. There's not just one, you don't just get one chance. You get many, many opportunities to experience.
I've had a man tell me that I was having some issues with some help. And I just said, I wish I knew what started this. I wish I knew when this problems, you know, manifested.
Yeah.
And he just looked at me very casually, said, 5 lifetimes ago.
There you go. Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I hadn't thought about it being a past trauma that's coming out now.
Yeah.
And that leads me to another thing I want to talk to you about. You underwent a Simba ritual, and I'd love to hear that story.
Yes, the Simba is it's a Swazi Zulu word, which means basically, I guess the closest translation would be exorcism.
Uh-huh.
Because I developed a strange autoimmune disorder in the mid-90s. I was working on a series called Mysteries of the Bible. I was the senior writer on the series. And suddenly one day, I didn't feel too great. And that evening at home, my wife looked down and she said, why are your ankles so swollen tonight? And I thought, gosh, I don't know. So I went to see my doctor, and he said, well, you better go and see a cardiac guy about your heart. Could be your heart, or it could be your kidneys. You better go and see a nephrologist as well. So I went to see both of them, and the nephrologist is the guy who found out that I was having massive problems with my kidneys. I had an autoimmune kidney disorder. My kidneys were basically under assault by my immune system.
Oh.
That was the beginning of another whole series of, well, adventures would not be the right way, but experiences, because I not only with Western medicine, but also in the shaman world, in the alternative world, in the world of alternative healing, because I wanted to do anything that I could to try and save my life and save my kidneys, you know. And what I did was I went back to Africa many times and met with a number of shamans who all analyzed my illness for me, with no stethoscopes, no fancy schmancy, you know, lab equipment. They all told me what was wrong with me by looking at the bones. And one guy said to me, you need to have this dark energy taken out of you, because there is something that is inside you that is dark and it's trying to kill you, and you have to have it removed. I had no idea what the darkness was or how you could remove it, what you could do. And this guy arranged for me to have a Femba. And I had it in a country which is now called Eswatini. It used to be called Swaziland. And Swaziland is a very, very small mountain kingdom that sits between South Africa and Mozambique. It's absolutely magnificent, a beautiful part of the world. And I met this man who also spoke no English. And it was arranged that he would do a Femba on me. Now, I was with a friend of mine who was studying the ways of the shamans. He's actually a surgeon. He lives here in California. And he was very interested in finding out how these healers in South Africa, how they can go out into the boondocks and choose leaves and barks and berries and herbs and various things and come back and concoct medicine out of it that cures people of illness, because that's what they were doing. He wanted to find out how they were learning this. And so he used to go back to South Africa a lot. And so he was studying the Sangomas back there. And he said, let's go and see. So he was with me on that particular trip. Or I was with him, really. And that's when it was decided that I would have this Femba done on this by this guy in Eswatini at his little compound, way up at the top of the mountaintops. You know, he took a Land Rover, you know, crunching up the mountainside for hours to get there. And when we eventually got to this place, it was the most amazing evening of my life, but it was also pretty damn terrifying, because there was this man. I was seated in this hut. It was a large hut. There was a fire in the center of this hut with a thatched roof and an opening at the top for the smoke to go out. And all around me were all these women drumming. And a lot of them had babies on their backs and, you know, babies sitting inside. But they were drumming, and, you know, it was straight out of a movie. It was straight out of King Solomon's Mines. It was straight out of Indiana Jones. It was amazing. And there I was sitting in the middle of the hut, and this guy eventually arrived to do the cleansing ceremony on me. He was dressed in like a grass skirt and beads all over, hanging from his neck, tied around his ankles, around his wrists. And his eyes were blood red when he entered the hut, and he sort of arrived there out of nowhere suddenly, and sort of, yeah! And I was scared out of my wits when he arrived. And he came into the hut, and then he dropped down onto his hands and knees, and he started sauntering towards me like an animal. And it reminded me of the way a hyena walks. And I absolutely believe that he had a hyena spirit that had taken over his being. And that animal was actually, he had become that animal. And he came up to me, and he started to smell me. I was wearing only a pair of shorts, nothing else. I was barefoot, bare-chested, which is what they asked me to do. And he started smelling me all the way from my feet, up my legs, right up to, you know, to the side. And when he got to the area of the left-hand side of my body where my kidney was, he started to heave as though he wanted to be ill, sick. And he yelled. And what these assistants came running to him with a container, a big earthenware pot, put it down next to him, and he sniffed at my at the site where my kidneys were, and he breathed in deeply, you know, sort of like that. It was terrifying, and then he vomited into this pot.
Oh my goodness!
Slimy stuff, and the same thing happened on the right hand side of my body. When he got to my right-hand side of my kidney, he started to heave and belch. And he brought up this ghastly little slime and vomited into this pot, into the container. And then he stood up in front of me, you know, and folded his arms and looked down at me. And he was speaking in Swazi, and all this was translated to me afterwards. And what he said was that the spirit of my grandfather was with him that night, guiding him, telling him what... Now,
whoa.
I'd never met my father, because my father's father, which is the man he was referring to, my father was from Latvia in Northern Europe, and my grandfather I never met. He died, you know, long before I was born. And he said to me that your father's father, your grandfather, was with him that night, telling him what to do and what was wrong with me, and that's how he found out the illness. And what he's done is he's now taken out the darkness from my body, and he's got rid of it from the body. And now every time that I go for a walk, I must think of my grandfather and be very grateful and think about him, because he helped him to get rid of this dark, whatever it is.
Amazing.
Material. Yeah, and, you know, it didn't cure me, because my kidneys had by then, I'd had this illness for a couple of decades. So they are damaged. But, you know, I'm still around, and my nephrologist said, you know, my nephrologist keeps telling me, he said, you know, you're going to be around for a long time. Your kidneys are impaired. You've got to deal with it. And I still do all the time. But he said, it's amazing how you have survived what you have. And I put it down to that evening, that event.
Absolutely. Yes. I can so understand that.
You know, what does all of this tell us? What does all of this teach us? I think, you know, after making all of these movies and, you know, exploring all these various facets of human nature and going on these amazing wild rides in the boondocks all over the world and doing all these things, you know, the takeaway lesson for me is that there is so much more to this world than we know. You know, there are so many more dimensions and layers and planes that we really don't know it all. And here we are in our Western society with all our technology and all the stuff that we can do, you know, and yet we really don't really know what makes it all tick and what makes it work. There's so much more to still find out, to explore. Nature is extraordinary. It is absolutely amazing. And I totally respect science, and I'm not knocking it at all. But you've got to go beyond these narrow perimeters and parameters that we often think in, and go beyond that and be open-minded, because there is so much more out there that we can embrace and that can help us define who we are and where we're going and what this journey of life is all about. Of that, there is absolutely no question in my mind.
Now, I think we're all connected, and we're more alike than we are dissimilar.
No doubt about it.
And I had a friend recently ask me, Mary, who's your cardiologist? I said, I don't have a cardiologist. She said, well, you're getting up in age. You're going to need one. I said, no, I don't. She said, well, who's your primary care physician? And I said, well, it's my Chinese doctor, my traditional Chinese medicine doctor. I've used traditional Chinese medicine for 21 years.
Yes.
And I will never use, I mean, only in extreme rare cases would I even consider going to anything else, because this guy he's protected me and helped me and fixed so many things that, you know, And he's done it without side effects.
Yeah. I don't doubt that for a minute.
Hats off to the people who have, you know, I look at Western medicine as a budding technology, you know, Chinese medicine and these African, I can't remember the word.
Well, call them shamans, because that's what they are. They're shamans.
And shamans in any culture, whether it's, you know, South America or whatever.
In North America as well. I mean, we had,
you
know, here as well. You know, they're wonderful people.
That kind of medicine, plant medicine, basically, has been around for thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. I don't know how long mankind's been around, but ever since the first man walked out and said, oh, my tummy hurts, well, I'm going to eat this branch, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But that's been around for a long, long time. The medicine that most people believe in that works with pharmacies and chemicals, that's only been around a couple hundred years.
Yeah.
So my hat's off to the ones that understand. And I also work with an energy healer, and it's been amazing.
Oh, of course. These people are, if you know, and it's sometimes difficult for folks to be able to tell, you know, a charlatan from a real person. There's a lot of noise out there. A lot of people profess to be able to do things, and you know, they're just milking you for your money. They don't really. But the genuine ones, the ones that are really honest and who come to you with conviction and commitment, and absolute integrity and honesty, which most of them do, you know, are amazingly powerful and capable people, and we need to, you know, embrace them in our thinking, and be open to that. It's not just, you know, it's not just about X-rays and CAT scans. It's so much more.
Yeah, by the time I would go to a Western doctor, and they did, you know, do the blood work, do the lab work, check this, check that, let's send her here, send her there. By the time I would finish with that, my traditional Chinese herbal medicine would have fixed the problem.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Now, I've got a question
because
we're nearly out of time, but I want to make sure that people know where they can buy Forever in My Veins.
Sure. It's available from Amazon.com online.
Okay.
Barnes & Noble have the book. Most bookstores, if they don't have it in stock, they can order it for you. But Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble online, they can order it. And it's called Forever in My Veins, and it's available worldwide. Any Amazon.com here, in the and Amazon.com, of course, have got services all over the world. So, yeah, it's available on all of those sites.
And I will tell you, folks, I've read the book. I reviewed it in Be Unique. It is phenomenal. It just, I can't tell you how many times the hair on my arms would just stand up when I would read things. Because it was, you know, like I said, and like you've said, we're connected. The world is connected.
We're all together. In fact, Mary, if you may remember, I end the book, the very last page of the book is I give this analogy about, you know, the bumper cars, those dodging cars at the fairground.
Yeah.
You know, at the back of those little cars is a sort of aerial going up, touching a sort of chicken wire ceiling on top, you know, which supplies the power to run these little cars. And I said, we are all in one of those little bumper car things, one of those little dodging cars, all of us. And behind us is a little aerial that goes up touching something very similar to that. I call it the field. Call it the essence, if you like. Call it whatever you want. But there is definitely a unifying field. And it's not just here down on the earth plane. I believe it's on a cosmic level. I believe it exists everywhere throughout the universe. We are all somehow connected to that field. We are all one. And we all can communicate and somehow give and take, and receive and be part of the same energy field that drives us all. And again, I'm going to quote myself. I said, whether you're a person or a pony, Tunia, we're all part of that field. And I absolutely, firmly am convinced of that fact. And if we learn how to connect with that, I meditate twice a day. And that's where I make my connection with my use. I call it my cosmic connection. And I derive enormous strength and confidence and positivity from that. And I feel at one with everybody, You know, we're all one when it comes down to it.
We absolutely are. And I think that's what's going to save our world is when more people realize how much connectivity there is between us. And we realize that we are here to protect this earth.
Yes, there's more that unites us than keeps us apart. Yeah, sure, no question. And I think that applies to everything. I apply that to the animal kingdom as well. I mean, you know, we're all together. We're all connected.
But just like you said, you've got a spiritual connection with that elephant as she died at your feet, basically.
Absolutely.
You've carried that connection with you ever since.
Yeah, she's been protecting me. I know she has. There's no doubt. I don't doubt that for a moment. So I think, you know, what folks can get from the book is a vision of, you know, that there's so much more. And it's easy to get to have a feeling of despair and a feeling of, you know, what's the point of going on, particularly with COVID and all the other stuff that we have to deal with all the time. You know, every day there's something new that makes you feel miserable and makes you feel, deflated. But there is so many reasons to continue and to continue on this incredible journey. We are all on a journey, Cosmos, every single one of us, and we need to take hope and heart from that, because there is so much more than the stuff that surrounds us on our daily physical lives and on this physical level. There is just so much more, and if we are only aware of that and tap into that source, you know, life begins to make so much more sense and begins to get to fill you with joy and with confidence and with optimism again. And I think people can use a bit of that right now, you know.
I think so. And every story, in every little, you know, anecdote in your book, you know, the whole connection of one thing leading to another, every bit is a positive. It just makes you feel good. Reading your book makes me feel good. And I think it's exactly what people need today.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying that. I appreciate that. That was the intent, you know. I just wanted to share it with the world because I feel as though I've been blessed, and why keep it to myself? That's why I wrote the book. I wanted to spread the word and get it out there so people could feel the same as I do now.
That's awesome. That's an excellent reason for writing a book. And on that note, I'm going to have to say goodbye. I really enjoyed talking with you, and I wish you all the best in the world.
Thank you so much, Mary, and I reciprocate those greetings not only to you but to all of your listeners. And be positive,
thank you.
All of us. Yeah. Thank
Amen.
You.
All right, bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you for listening this evening. We're happy you chose to spend this time with us, and we hope you learned as much as we did.
Every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
And if you'd like us to invite you or someone you know to speak right here, just go to beunique.org and contact us there.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around the fact that our newly branded podcast has so many global listeners and that our website and magazine receive thousands of visitors each month. Let's put your brand in front of all those people. Mary can share the demographics with you. Contact her through the website. That's BUNEKE.org.